Hello, this is Bob Krueger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food for November 2010. November is the month in which we observe Veterans Day on the 11th and Thanksgiving Day on the 25th. The weather is cooler, many of the leaves have fallen, it is surely a time to enjoy more warm meals. Soups, stews, and hot serves for breakfast seem to hit the spot. Are you planning to bake a fruitcake for the holidays? Stores have already received their shipments of candied fruit and many kinds of shelled nuts. Items like canned breads, mincemeat, and other holiday specialties are now in stock. If you plan to use any of these items, it would be wise to purchase them now. These items probably cannot be reordered, and stores like to sell out. Don't wait until the store is out of stock. Is peanut butter a food for children only? Who cares if it sticks to the roof of your mouth? Where would we be without peanut butter and jelly, or Reese's peanut butter cups, or peanut butter crackers? Americans eat 7 pounds of peanut butter per person each year, and it's rightly so. It's tasty, nutritious, cheap, and non-perishable. 2 tablespoons have 8 grams of protein, 12 grams of unsaturated fat, the good kind, and even more, resveratrol, the antioxidant that gives red wine a good name. All of this for about 20 cents a serving. Those same 2 tablespoons also have 190 calories, so instead of standing over the jar with a spoon, incorporate peanut butter into a meal. Look for a brand that contains only peanuts and salt. Some commercial brands have added fat and sugar, trying to branch out beyond peanut butter and jelly. And here are some ideas you might want to try. Make a simple peanut butter sauce in the blender with peanut butter, lemon juice, soy sauce, and some fresh ginger and garlic. Thin this with chicken broth until it's the right consistency, and for variations, add hot pepper flakes, cilantro, or honey. Serve over vegetables, noodles, seafood, or grilled meat. Make a simple peanut butter soup by sautéing an onion and some garlic and adding 1/2 cup of peanut butter, a few tablespoons of tomato paste, and 3 cups of chicken broth. Season with salt, pepper, and a dash of Tabasco sauce, and garnish some chopped leaf parsley. Have you ever had a peanut butter smoothie? Add the 2 tablespoons of peanut butter to a frozen banana, 1/2 to 3/4 cup of milk, and a little sugar. Make a peanut butter sandwich with something other than jelly. Bananas are classic, but try dates, apples, and even bacon. Combine it with vinegar and layer with chicken and Swiss cheese on a pizza crust for an Asian pizza. I'm one adult who believes that peanut butter is for all ages. We have read or heard of fabulous foods that are available at this year's North Carolina State Fair. We were blessed with great weather, and attendance went over 1 million folks for the first time. One day, people at the fair were standing in line, not for anything deep-fried or dusted with confectioner's sugar, but to taste cheeses. For the first time, the state's artisan cheesemakers had a presence at the fair. Their tent, which was tucked into a space between the grim Jim Graham Building and the Expo Center, offered North Carolina cheesemakers a chance to make sales and, more important, an opportunity to introduce their products to a wider audience. It's a great exposure for our cheesemakers. It's a great exposure for the dairy industry, said Portia McKnight, who, with Flo Hawley, owns the Chapel Hill Creamery. Cheesemaking is on the rise in the state. 2 years ago, there were 26 licensed cheesemakers in North Carolina, more than any other southeastern state. Now there are 32. 3 years ago, there were about 6,000 dairy goats in the state, and now there are about 9,500. As a result, North Carolina's cows and goat's milk cheeses are becoming more readily available to consumers. It's not just farmers' markets anymore, said Matt Lang, the dairy development coordinator with the industry group North Carolina Dairy Advantage. It's at grocery stores, restaurants, and CSAs. CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture, is a process by which consumers buy weekly shares of a farmer's produce. Local cheese is becoming a popular addition to farmers' CSA offerings. The cheesemaker tent made its debut at the North Carolina Mountain State Fair outside Asheville in February. And during the fair's 10-day run, the cheesemaker sold $4,000 worth of cheese, said Stephen Rathrop, a dairy marketing specialist with the State Department of Agriculture. Lathrop expects sales at the state fair to exceed the total because this fair attracts four times as many visitors. The four cheesemakers at the North Carolina State Fair were Chapel Hill Creamery, the Elodie Farms at Rougemont, Holly Grove Farm in Mount Olive, and the Calico Farmstead Cheese in Gibsonville. Got off to a great start the first weekend of the fair. The cheesemaker's tent was a Lathrop's idea and would not have been possible without the sponsorship by Whole Foods, which paid several thousand dollars to rent the space for the makers. Next year, Lathrop says he hopes to add a statewide cheese competition. Artisan cheese is made by hand using traditional methods. A farmstead cheese is an artisan cheese made by people who not only make the cheese, but raise the animals that produce the milk as well. Artisan cheese is not for everyone. Occasionally a person would try a sample and discreetly spit it out, moving on to enjoy more standard fare. But most would mutter, "Mmm, and that's really good," before asking where it could be purchased or buying some to take home. Though artisan cheeses were healthier than most fair foods, there was one item on a stick, small balls of fresh mozzarella. "We figured we needed something on a stick at the state fair," McKnight explained. "I have yet to find a cheese I don't like, although somewhere along the line I may have to eat my words. Congratulations to our North Carolina cheesemakers." One hot dish we can enjoy with the coming of cold weather is chowder. Have you any idea where this word came from? Ask for chowder and you could be repeating the first word coined by Europeans in America. Bring a spoonful to your mouth and you could be enjoying the first European-American dish. According to some historians, the word chowder was coined long before the pilgrims sighted Cape Cod. Fishermen from various countries in Europe had been haunting the fertile waters off Newfoundland since about the year 1000. And during their multilingual gatherings, they corrupted the French word chaudière, the pot in which the French fishermen made their stews, into the word chowder. These early chowders were different from our own. There was no milk, the nearest cow was 1,000 miles away, and certainly there were no potatoes. This was several centuries before the tuber would complete its triangular journey from South America, to Europe, to North America. Yet we would recognize the dish. Salt pork provided fat, onions added flavor, and ship's biscuits thickened the stew teemed with cod and clams. The addition of tomatoes was likely the work of Italian and Portuguese immigrants and a chef from New York's legendary Delmonico's restaurant who published a recipe for a tomato-laced chowder in 1889. New Englanders, staunchly loyal to their milky version, dubbed it Manhattan clam chowder. To them, tomato chowders were a heresy, and associated anything with New York was forbidden. As late as 1939, a bill was introduced in Maine making a statutory offense to put tomatoes in a chowder. Elsewhere, the word chowder is used for a variety of soups, including ingredients ranging from salmon to corn. A chowder may be defined by its chunkiness, while a bisque is typically pureed. Please leave the tomatoes out of my chowder. All news is not good news, but we must take the bitter with the sweet, and this story is an example. A recent news release from the U.S. Department of Agriculture tells us that food prices are going up. Food inflation will accelerate during the final months of this year and into the first 6 months of 2011. U.S. food companies have started to raise prices to blunt price spikes for a number of commodities, including corn, wheat, and coffee. Although inflation has been relatively weak for most of 2009 and 2010, higher food, commodity, and energy prices are now exerting pressure on wholesale and retail food prices, USDA food economist Ephraim Liebtag said. Still, the USDA left its 2010 forecast unchanged for food prices to increase 1.5% to 1.5%, the lowest rate of annual inflation in 18 years. Pork prices in 2010 are now forecasted to rise as much as 5.5% over 2009 compared with the August 25th estimate for the increase of up to 4%, the USDA said in its monthly update. Beef prices are expected to rise up to 3.5% against the previous 3% gain. Meat prices have been going up following a painful restructuring of U.S. meat companies that slashed output and bankrupted smaller hog producers. This has driven up hog and cattle prices in the futures market over the past year. When commodity prices rise for a prolonged period, it normally takes several months before those price gains find their way to the supermarket. Inflation comes at a tricky time for brand-name U.S. food makers, most of whom have been reluctant to pass along higher commodity prices. They are still coping with tight-fisted shoppers and rising food stamp usage. How consumers will respond to higher prices is uncertain after brand food companies cut prices this year to woo shoppers. General Mills announced its plan to raise prices on one-fourth of its breakfast cereals following a 25% jump in wheat prices so far this year. Sara Lee said in August it was raising prices for its breads and deli meats. J.M. Smucker, Kraft Food, and Starbucks have all raised coffee prices. Nor can shoppers expect much relief next year. The USDA has forecast that in 2011, food prices will rise 2 to 3% over this year. Dairy prices are expected to be up as much 5.5% over 2010. It had been predicted that milk prices would be over $4 a gallon by this time, but yet it hasn't happened. At the same time, the nation's cattle ranchers say that the market for domestic meat has withered to a point where they often receive only a single reasonable bid for their animals, a trend that could eventually mean less quality meat on dinner tables across the United States. The struggle to get a competitive price, they say, is helping push thousands of producers out of business and may pressure others to sell weaker, sicker cows for less tender, less flavorful meat and smaller ribeyes, for example. When the marketplace is not profitable, the only recourse a producer has is to cut the cost and try to produce more pounds with less money, said Bill Bullard, who was the chief executive officer of RCAF USA, a Montana-based trade group that represents cattle producers. The cash market for domestic beef has been declining for years, but the Associated Press interviewed cattle producers in the nation's biggest ranching states who have reported having no choice but to sell a vast majority of their cattle to one buyer. Producers almost never criticize the industry's leading meat packers because the companies are valued customers. An AP analysis of shipping logs and sales receipts form their accounts. There's actually no market. You either give them to these guys or you have no market, said Bob Sears, who ran one of Nebraska's biggest feeding lots until declaring bankruptcy in March. The complaints have also drawn the interest of federal regulators who are investigating possible antitrust violations in the meatpacking industry. Sears and other cattle producers suspect meatpackers are quietly cooperating to keep prices low in an area that stretches from Kansas to Nebraska and South Dakota, the region that dominates U.S. cattle production. Industry representatives insist there's no collusion and that dwindling numbers of bids reflect broader changes in the way beef is bought and sold throughout the nation. Without a competitive market, experts say, cattle production could lose the motivation to raise high-quality meat, and some of them might cut corners on medicine, feed, and veterinary care. My personal feeling is that when the antitrust people allowed the combination of large companies, especially meat packers, they created this situation wherein there are many fewer packers bidding for the ranchers' cattle. A peek into the kitchen of more than 450 food service establishments in Wake County suggests that fewer people would get foodborne illnesses if the state adopted federal safety rules that are stricter about such items as food temperatures and hand washing. Wake County has released the result of a survey that was based on a six-page questionnaire and unannounced visits to 458 randomly selected establishments as a part of a voluntary program with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The county's environmental health director, Andre Pierce, says the survey gives the county an idea of what areas it will need to stress as the state moves closer to July 2012, when it's tentatively scheduled to adopt the FDA food safety rules. We're putting up the stoplights before the wrecks occur, Pierce said. North Carolina has the most dated food safety regulations in the country, according to the FDA. The state's rules are based on guidelines developed in 1976 and are cumbersome to update. Pierce said enforcement is comparatively aggressive, done by a small army of inspectors in each county. Overall, the state is considered among the top 5 in terms of food safety, according to the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. But there have been notable lapses resulting in the outbreak of illnesses, including hundreds of people getting sick after dining at different eateries in Wake County in the late 2009 and earlier this year. Existing state regulations could have prevented some of these illnesses, said Ben Chapman, a food safety specialist at NC State University. But it's difficult to get complete compliance. Rules are only one of the factors, Chapman said. Legislation can only go so far. What's more important is what happens when the inspector's not there. You have to find a way to encourage everyone, from the business owner down to the 15-year-old who works in the kitchen, in the concept that we need to prevent foodborne illnesses. The Food and Drug Administration regulations are generally considered the best in the industry, and because they were hammered out in meetings every few years and updated on a basis of scientific data, they're the most current. Some chain restaurants operate in the state comply with FDA rules because their headquarters are in states that use them. North Carolina health officials and food industry representatives are to begin meeting in the next few months to discuss the FDA rules in hope of putting them into effect in Wake County by mid-2012. If the rules were in place today, the survey found two areas where many facilities would not meet the standards. Across a range of commercial kitchens, surveyors found that managers need to better monitor how long food is kept once it is opened and prepared, require cold foods to be kept at 45 degrees, for example. The FDA requirement is 41 degrees. Also, state rules don't require that ready-to-eat foods be marked with the date they're opened. The FDA does. The survey found that employees handling ready-to-eat foods often work barehanded and do not properly wash their hands. Pierce said that hand-washing and requiring workers to wear gloves would reduce the spread of many pathogens. Surveyors visited full-service and fast-food restaurants, as well as nursing homes, elementary schools, meat and seafood markets, delis, and produce departments. Paul M. Stone, the president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association based in Raleigh, said his industry welcomes the stricter regulations. Our motives are just like the health official motives, Stone said. We want to serve clean, healthy food in a safe environment. In a statement released October 22nd, federal health officials said that as many as 1 in 3 U.S. adults could have diabetes by the year 2050, in a dramatic revision of earlier projections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 1 in 10 has diabetes now, but the number could grow to 1 in 5 or even 1 in 3 by mid-century if the current trends continue. This is alarming, said Ann Albright, the director of the CDC's Division of Diabetes Translation. The agency's projections have been a work in progress. The last vision put the number at 39 million in 2050. The new estimate takes it to the range of 76 to 100 million. An estimated 24 million Americans have diabetes at this time. The new calculation accounts for people who have diabetes but are undiagnosed, a group that wasn't figured in the earlier estimates, said Edward Gregg, the chief of the CDC's branch that handles diabetes epidemiology and statistics. Also, researchers using new population growth estimates for the elderly and the minorities who have higher rates of type 2 diabetes, he said. One more factor, diabetics are living longer because of improvements in medical care, he said. Diabetes is a disease in which the body has trouble processing sugar. It was the nation's 7th leading cause of death in 2007. In the classic form of diabetes, the body does not produce enough of a hormone called insulin to help sugar get into the cells. That's type 1 diabetes. Another form of diabetes, type 2, now accounts for about 95% of cases. In that kind, the body's cells resist insulin's attempts to transport sugar. Type 2 is most common in people who are overweight and obese, in people 60 and older, and in African American and other minority groups. The growth in U.S. diabetes cases have been closely tied to escalating obesity rates. Recent CDC data suggests obesity rates may have leveled off recently. But the new estimate should hold up even if the obesity rates remain static, CDC officials said. Blue Cross and Blue Shields Foundation is starting a $3 million three-year effort to fight obesity in young children. Executives with the foundation, funded by the state's largest health insurer, announced the initiatives with officials for the North Carolina Partnership for Children in Charlotte. The program, called Shape North Carolina Healthy Starts for Young Children, will focus on kids through age five by working to improve nutrition and encouraging physical activity at the state's 5,000 licensed daycare centers. Some children spend 10 hours a day or more in such settings where they eat at least two meals and two snacks. Some of the money will provide more training and resources so child care teachers can promote healthy behaviors during early years. It's a great way to get at this group of young children whom we see every day, said Stephanie Fanjul, the president of the North Carolina Partnership for Children, which oversees the state's Smart Start program. It's a beginning, but it's a pretty substantive beginning. Shape North Carolina will build on the work of other programs, including Smart Start, which collaborates with more than 70 local nonprofits across the state, and Be Active Kids, another Blue Cross effort focusing on childhood physical activity. Other partners include researchers at UNC Chapel Hill and at NC State University. Nearly 17% of U.S. medical costs can be blamed on obesity, or about $168 billion a year, according to a study released last month by the National Board of Economic Research. The study found that being obese adds more than $2,800 to a person's annual medical bills. North Carolina has the fifth highest rate of childhood obesity in the nation, and 31% of children ages 2 to 4 are overweight or at the risk of becoming obese, according to Shape North Carolina's organizers. Let's hope this program shows positive results. The glory of North Carolina is in the changing of seasons, always giving something to look forward to, in some ways reinvent ourselves. The same is true when it comes to the dinner table. The nip in the air makes it okay to fire up the oven again, so think braises, roasts, and casseroles. Brown food, with its rich nuances of flavors and textures, replaces the sunshine of a fresh tomato and leads us down different garden paths. Such a path could lead us to a cabbage patch. Cabbage flavor really peaks in the fall and early winter and should be treated with more respect than just a plate filler side dish of coleslaw. But good coleslaw is a great addition to a number of meals. Cabbage, more than likely, was taken to the mountains in North Carolina by the original Scotch-Irish settlers as a main source of food. It lent itself well to the cool climate and slightly unforgiving soil of the Blue Ridge. Cabbage cooked with a small amount of bacon and ham could have been stretched to feed a clan for relative pennies. Along with corn, cabbage became one of the essential crops. Imagine a meal of braised cabbage, cornbread, and a pot of slow-cooked pinto beans. Add a few bits of chopped raw onion in the beans, and I'm ready to put my feet under that table. This information about cabbage came from Fred Thompson's column, Weekend Gourmet, which appears in the News and Observer. In my home, we often serve steamed cabbage and add a few pieces of the artificial bacon bits that are made from soybeans. Often while going through a line in the cafeteria, we see cabbage that's been boiled until it's a slightly red color. Don't get it any that looks like that. It's been overcooked, and what flavor it might have had is gone. Pork is often served with cabbage, and I think you might like this short article by John Edward White that appeared in the Christian Science Monitor. He begins, "Give me a pair of pan-thick fried pork chops cooked to perfect pinkness with homemade applesauce and sauerkraut on the side, and I'm in hog heaven. My fondness for these porkine poppers hasn't always existed. My mother was an excellent cook. When it came to pork chops, she should have stuck to seven-can casserole. Her pork chops were thin as CDs, fried to a frazzle, and tough enough to shingle our garage roof. Then again, maybe you couldn't get a thick pork chop back in the Middle Ages. Today, there's no excuse. You can get pork chops from your butcher just as thick as you like, or you can buy a pork rib roast and cut them yourself. The thicker, the better. For frying or grilling, they should be from 3/4 to an inch thick. But there's still some problems when it comes to cooking pork chops, the fat factor being one. They are inherently lean, and fat, as we know, gives both flavor and tenderness to meat. The other problem is overcooking. The USDA suggests that pork be cooked to a temperature of 160 degrees. That means a roast should be taken out of the oven when it reaches 155 degrees and left to rest for a half an hour. This ensures a slightly pink center and a tender roast. Mr. White is correct that today's pork on the market is much leaner than the pork of his mother's day. Often, the way that we are introduced to a new product coming to the market is a coupon in a newspaper, and such is the case with some new seasonings from Land O'Lakes. When we think of Land O'Lakes, we immediately think of butter and dairy products. And three of these new items are shakers, containers holding a Parmesan cheese, an herb mixture, a sharp cheese, and a butter-flavored item. Think of them as a type of cheese product that you would shake on pasta and salads. This is another example of a company expanding their product line. And here is another of those letters to the food editor, an answer that might be of interest to us. Question: I have just made my first ever beef stock. How long will it keep in the refrigerator? Or is it best to freeze and take it out when I need it? And the answer? Congratulations on entering the wonderful world of stock making. Satisfying, isn't it? Stock will keep about 4 days in the refrigerator if you chill it properly. To do that, let it cool properly. It's not a good idea to put a large container of hot liquid straight into your refrigerator. The container won't cool all the way through quickly enough, and it'll raise the temperature in the refrigerator, which is hard on the other food around it. You can divide the warm stock into smaller containers to chill it quickly. Or you can put the whole container of stock in a large bowl of ice and stir it regularly until it is no longer piping hot. Even if you're going to freeze the stock, refrigerate it overnight is a good idea. The fat will rise to the top and harden, make it easier to remove. Freezing is your best long-term option. Make sure you measure the stock to make it easier to use later. I usually make up freezer bags with 1-cup and 2-cup portions so I can pull them out when I need them. Using freezer bags or freezer containers, and make sure you label and date them. It takes a few minutes of effort, but it pays off. Having stock you made yourself waiting in the freezer is like having a jump start on hundreds of recipes. The same could be made for making chicken stock. Today, so many recipes call for chicken stock. It's great to know you have it on hand in your freezer. Many of us will sit down to a feast on Thanksgiving Day that includes many of the traditional friends' foods that we have expected, and most of us will eat more than we should. Do you have a neighbor or a friend who has no family close? Why not have them join you for dinner? If you don't feel up to preparing a holiday meal, many restaurants now serve Thanksgiving dinners. Don't wait until the last minute to purchase the main course for your holiday meal. Plan your meal ahead of time and create your own menu and do as much advanced planning as possible. Any special occasion is no fun if we end up tired, tense, and frustrated. Make sure you get some help in the cleanup job after the meal and take care of the leftovers before they sit out in the temperature too long. We've running out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food, and be sure to listen the same time next month. And this has been Bob Kruger reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you.